You are listening to an audiobook podcast of A Rake by Starlight, written and narrated by C.B. Wright. This podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons license. The author would like to apologize to the entire nation of Scotland for Cyrus Mack's accent. Chapter 4, wherein a search for hidden treasure produces uneven results. Mack Wallen was a short, stocky man. It wasn't a build most people associated with his work, but his heft was deceptive. Mack had been an asteroid miner before embarking on a life of crime, and he and his crew were old hands at working in zero gravity. That was what convinced Captain Vind to bring them on. It hadn't been an easy decision from his perspective. He didn't know anything about them. Ship mutinies were on the rise. Vind decided to take the risk, after taking great pains to describe what had happened to the other hires who'd tried to mutiny on his boat. And after a few months, Mack thought the rest of the crew was starting to warm up to them. Cyrus, more than the others. Amos, significantly less.
"We are ready, Digger."
Sardrumshak sealed the helmet of his vacuum suit, and the effect was eerie. Gagrulsha fur partially absorbed most spectrums of light, making them very hard to see clearly. Under the best conditions, they looked like blurry, vaguely humanoid splashes of darkness. Through the slight tint in the vacuum suit helmet, Sar didn't look like anything at all. Mack was used to it.
"Ready to go?"
Faiz Kallik had joined Mack and Sar 3 years back, when they were doing a lot of security work for the Nist Barony. She flashed a reckless smile and nudged the fourth member of their group, who was just finishing up fastening the seal of his helmet. "Junior is too." Adru Beat was actually a few years older than Faiz, but he joined the group a few months after she did, and the nickname stuck. He bore it stoically.
"Let's get this done."
"Hear that, Cap? We're ready to cross."
Captain Vin's voice cut in on the line.
"Well, first things first. This just got more interesting."
They were new to the crew, but they'd been around long enough to know that when Vind called something interesting, it was safer to think of it as complicated and dangerous.
"Okay," Mack said cautiously. "We already know she's half a ship and tumbling nose over end. How much more interesting is it getting?"
Captain Vind coughed apologetically. "Okay, Mack, here's the deal. When the gunboat blew, it turned into a cloud of radiation and bits of really sharp metal, and Amos just told me the cargo ship is going to pass through it in about 4.5 hours. Mack did some quick calculations in his head and estimated it would take half an hour to board, half an hour to return. That gave them a little less than 3.5 hours to do any actual exploring.
"Not a lot of time to look around," he said.
"No," the captain agreed.
"Get to the bridge or some kind of central station and try to copy as much data as you can. Morgan thinks there might still be juice in the auxiliary power cells."
"So we do as much as we can in 3 hours and come back before we pass through a cloud of sharp, pointy death."
Vin's voice grew cheerful. "That's about right."
"Shouldn't be too bad, really," Mack said,
as much for his own benefit as it was for the others.
"I've had tougher jobs mining rock in the Tyrella system."
"That is true, Digger,"
Sargrumshak agreed.
"But we had equipment better suited to the job."
Gagrulsha had an annoying habit of bestowing people with names they felt best reflected their nature. Mack, for example, was called Digger. He'd been a miner for most of his life, and according to Sar, had never really left that life behind. Most Gagrulsha had another annoying habit. They were painfully blunt. While his observation was true, Mack wished he hadn't pointed it out on an open channel. Fortunately, the captain didn't find it insulting. Instead, he laughed. "I always planned on stocking up on some proper salvage equipment, just for situations like this. Never got around to buying it. Tell you what, after this is over, make a list of all the things that would have made your life easier, and I'll try to come up with some good excuses not to buy them." Mack grinned. Faiz and Adro laughed. Sar shrugged, obviously not understanding what the others found so funny.
"All right," Mack said. "Let's get started."
The Apex lock took them to the outer hull of the Fool's Errand. In the distance, they could see what remained of the cargo ship. The front of the ship was mostly intact. Midship was where the hull cracked open. Behind it, a debris field of polymer and twisted metal spread out like a billowing cloud. That wasn't the tricky part. The tricky part was that the nose of the ship was tumbling. The other tricky part was that in a few hours, it would tumble right through the remains of the gunboat. As a miner, he knew there were ways to stop or slow the rotation of an object in space. It usually took time and a significant amount of explosives, however, and they had neither on hand. This meant they were going to have to match its rotation the hard way.
Let's go.
Mac gripped the propulsion sled in front of him and felt his arms lock into the armrests. He hit the release button, then lifted it gently so it rose slightly above the hull. He looked at the others to make sure they were doing the same thing. Satisfied, he squeezed the sled's grips and felt himself being pulled forward. Leading the way, Mac glided through space, the wreckage of the cargo vessel growing ever larger. He watched the instrumentation on the propulsion sled carefully, monitoring radiation levels. The suits could handle everything they would be looking around, assuming Morgan's sensor readings were correct, and as far as Mac could tell, the old man knew what he was about. But the levels were still high. Detox wasn't pleasant, and cancer meds had very inconvenient side effects. As they closed in, Mac realized that more of the ship was intact than he'd originally thought. Perspective in space was tricky. What had looked like only a very small piece of the cargo ship moments before was almost the size of the fool's errand.
"Looks like there are 6 or 7 decks to go through," Mac said. "About 100, 150 meters per deck."
"Good," Vind said. "That means there's a chance all the burning and exploding stopped before it reached the bridge. You might actually find some intact computers."
"I wonder what it was carrying," Adro said.
"Not that we'll find out. The cargo bay didn't survive."
"If we can get a computer to work," Sar growled, "we can look at its manifest."
They were almost at the hull now. Mac angled the sled, flying parallel, approaching the gaping hole at the end. This was tricky because the ship was tumbling and he had to constantly adjust his course to keep from crashing into the hull as he flew.
"Almost at the end."
A stream of junk poured out behind the ship. Twisted alloy of all shapes and sizes made a great arch across the vacuum. Mac angled his sled to move behind the ship and had to dodge quickly to avoid a large chunk of free-floating hull that appeared suddenly in his field of view.
"Still a little messy down here," he warned. "Stay alert."
One advantage of the ship's tumbling was that the back was moving away from most of the debris. The main danger would be from the remains still shaking themselves loose, like the piece of hull he'd just dodged.
"How much time?" Mac asked.
After a short delay, Vind replied, 3 hours, 40 minutes. Mac gritted his teeth. It took them 20 minutes longer to get to the ship than he'd planned.
"Right."
He adjusted his sled to keep pace with the ship. When everything lined up, he shot a tether to the ship's hull. He could see Sar do the same thing a little farther down. Farther still, Adro and Faiz moved into position.
"I'm reeling in."
The tether began to retract, pulling Mac closer. The spot he'd attached himself to was a piece of exposed deck that looked stable. Assuming he was right, it would allow him access to the interior of the ship while making it easier for him to leave when the time came. The sled managed to keep pace with the ship, and Mac didn't turn off the propulsion until he was 5 or 6 meters from the deck. When he finally did, he was able to land on the deck and activate the grips on his boots without too much of a shock. Then, after securing the propulsion sled to the deck itself, he began to take a look around.
"I'm in," he said.
Adro, Faiz, and Sar chose other decks to explore. Splitting up on a salvage operation wasn't necessarily the safest thing to do, but they were pressed for time. Each called in when they touched down, then exploration began in earnest. Mac saw an interior hatch, what was left of it, and stepped through. The other side was a different world. It was difficult to tell that anything had happened to the ship at all. The passage was dark and the terminals on the walls were dead, but aside from the hatch, there was no sign of structural damage.
"Looks almost normal here," Mac said. "It's a little creepy, to tell you the truth."
"Not down here," Faiz said.
Her voice was light and cheerful, pure bravado. That was the voice she used when she wasn't enjoying herself. Hull breach here. Lots of explosive decompression. Dead bodies everywhere. Max stepped into a small, empty common area, hatches on each side.
This is definitely a Tylaris Barony cargo ship,
Sar growled.
I have found the captain's office. The door bears the Baron's mark. There is also some auxiliary lighting. If I can enter the office, the computer should work.
That's great, Captain Vin chimed in. The captain should have access to all the logs. That's what we want right there. Can you get in?
The door is locked, Sar said. But I can burn through it. 20 minutes.
My deck was general quarters, I think, Faiz said. No auxiliary lighting. Lots of personal effects and clothes. Plenty to take if we had more time. No point, given our window. Wreck area here, Adro chimed in. No bodies, though. Makes sense. You don't find too many people hanging around the wreck area when your ship's being blown to bits.
Mostly useless stuff here, Matt groused. Empty rooms, no purpose that I can see. Maybe some maintenance stations. I think I'm wasting my time up here, Captain. Maybe I should give Sara...
Mac stopped in his tracks and frowned.
Give Sara what?
Mac?
Hold on. I think I found something interesting.
Mac stepped through the hatch into what looked like a miniature hangar. It was 10 meters to a side, and in the center sat a platform with moorings that looked like they'd been released with explosive charges. The outer bulkhead was gone, probably blown apart, but the interior showed no signs of scorching.
Captain.
Mac looked around the room, then through the hole in the outer bulkhead. He could see the Fool's Errand from here, slowly moving out of view as the ship tumbled on.
I think I found a squib.
Did you now? Captain Vind sounded very surprised.
That's interesting. Yeah, Mac agreed.
A squib was an escape pod, rigged so it would look like detritus blown off a ship during a fight. The exit path was rigged to explode, causing bits of the hull to fly off in all directions. It was also usually a non-standard shape. If it launched, powered down, it could fool a sensor tech into thinking it was just another piece of scrap. If the squib was launched correctly, it could be hurled quite a distance before it needed to activate onboard navigation and engines. He walked over to the platform and knelt to look at the moorings. He found scorching, and made note of the pattern it burned into the floor.
Definitely a squib. I found the burn pattern from the launch charges.
Right. There was a moment of silence on the other end of the channel as Vind considered his options. I want whatever records Sar can pull from the captain's office, but other than that, I'm scrubbing the rest of the salvage.
Aye, aye, Captain, Max said. Team, you heard the man. Let's help Sar, then go back home.
Chapter 5. Wherein motive is both rigorously examined and studiously ignored.
So there's enough power to copy the ship's manifest and some of her logs, but not all of them. We're making our best guess as to what you'll find useful, but we can't make any promises. We've got most of the captain's logs, what we can find, but they're encrypted and may only be partial files. We can't tell.
Max sounded slightly defensive over the comm channel.
We're going to wrap up in another 10 minutes. I don't want to be here when the debris hits.
Understood, Griff said. Get what you can in the time you have, then get out. Drinks are on me. The channel lapsed into silence.
End communication, Faldith announced.
That went well. Griff leaned back in his chair and gazed out from the pilot's nest into the magnificent view. He couldn't see the damaged ships. They were turned away from them at the moment, with rear screens up to block any stray debris that might be floating their way. But he had a good view of Uru, the gas giant. It was on the small side, as far as gas giants went, but it was still impressive, even at this distance.
You think they're gonna find anything about the squib? Morgan asked.
If I had a squib on my ship, I'd never put it on record, Amos said. If I had to use it, I wouldn't be taking the records with me. No point in having a secret escape pod if someone you're trying to escape from can read about it later.
I take your point, Morgan said, but it'd be awfully convenient if we could find something that mentions where the squib went.
Any chance you can track it down? Griff asked.
Doubt it, Morgan said. Sensors won't be too much help. I can randomly pick points in the sky to spy on, but I won't know where to look. Any trail it might have left will be washed out by the radiation left behind from two very large explosions.
Griff didn't really expect a different answer.
Too bad. We'll have to do this the hard way, then. We need to figure out what they intended when they launched the squib.
The bridge settled into contemplative silence. A few minutes later, Mac announced over the comm channel that they'd finished downloading all the data they could and were headed back to the Fool's Errand. Then the bridge settled into more contemplative silence.
Well, Amos said, voice dry, I think they wanted to get away.
Griff grinned. Well, yes, obviously there's that. But that can't be all of it. Mac's team says there are bodies on board. They didn't all evacuate in squibs. You use a squib when you're trying to pull a fast one, so what kind of fast one were they trying to pull?
It was a pretty small craft, Amos said. Mac said the room was 10 by 10. That's a crew of one with a little extra room for storage. So what were they moving? A person they didn't want caught? Or cargo they didn't want intercepted?
Do we really want to know?
Feldeath asked.
Two Tylaris Barony ships, no signature beacons, fighting each other. It's obviously political.
She made an unhappy gurgling sound in the back of her throat.
Politics isn't profitable. You say that all the time.
And I'm right, Griff said. The only people who profit from politics are groups who have a shot at gaining power, or the big outfits who can absorb the risk while charging obscene rates to do the dirty work for the groups who have a shot at gaining power. It doesn't look like we're going to get any decent salvage off these ships. It's too much work at this point. It all adds up to us being better off if we don't know.
Then why are we pursuing this?
Feldeath asked. Griff slid his chair out of the pilot's nest, up along the rails and into the bridge proper, where it locked into place with a loud click. Simple. I really, really want to know. The wheezing, splorching sound Feldeath made probably meant she was unhappy. Amos sighed sympathetically.
Didn't you recently make a big speech about how you didn't care why the two ships were fighting? Amos asked. I could have sworn you did, just a few hours ago.
That was before I learned about the squib, Griff said. I didn't care then. I do now. I've never understood why people use squibs. They're inherently defeatist. When you put a squib on your ship, you're essentially saying, I believe someone is going to blow so much of my ship apart that this misshapen escape pod will fit right in, which is a rather specific scenario to plan for. Someone planned for it in this instance, and I want to know why.
Captain Wallace would not get involved in this, Feldeath said.
No, Amos agreed.
On the other hand, Feldeath added thoughtfully, Captain Vind does not shoot his own crew.
Morgan scratched his beard thoughtfully. Well, I think it has to be a person. You don't need a squib to get rid of cargo, you just dump it into space. If these two ships represented different factions in the Tylaris Barony, I'm going to guess that the Sunts was part of the Old Guard, who don't think much of the new Baron, and whoever skipped off in the squib was one of their leaders.
Could be, Griff said. But if it is a person, they're screwed. The only habitable planet in this system is Tobanth, which is light hours away. A squib's drive won't make it that far.
Escaping in a squib isn't a long-term plan, Amos said. It's a last-minute plan. It's what you do when everything else has gone horribly wrong. Look at it that way. You just got into a squib and shot yourself into space. How do you improvise? Griff stood up, stretched, and started to pace the bridge.
Well, I want the other side to think I'm just another piece of scrap, so the first thing I do is drift. I drift, and I keep drifting because I don't want the ship to notice that I have propulsion.
Even if they board my ship, which they did, and they find the squib hangar, they're not going to know how to find me. I'm tiny. There's a lot of debris. I buy that, Amos said, but then you see your ship explode. And then you see the other ship explode. Right, Griff said. That's when I think I'm screwed. But I'm screwed and I'm alive, and I don't want that last part to change, but I don't have a plan, unfortunately. Morgan keyed in a command to his station, and the large screen at the fore of the bridge displayed a schematic of the Obachi system. A red dot pinpointed their position. They were almost to the outermost of Uru's moons. I'd try to get to Tobanth anyway. It's my best shot. Griff shook his head. 4 light hours, Morgan. A squib wouldn't have the speed. Maybe send out a distress call?
I would have noticed that, Faldith said.
So not that, then? Griff frowned. Why were they here in the first place? It is a Tylera system, Amos said, technically. Only just. I suppose they might have a contact in one of the mining colonies, but if you consider we could have taken their biggest colony out by ourselves if we really wanted to, I'm not seeing a tactical advantage there. Me either, Amos agreed. Despite her best efforts, she felt herself being pulled into the mystery of it all. Anyway, it wouldn't make any sense because they were... Amos's voice trailed off. Griff glanced at her. She was staring off into space, frowning slightly as she tried to work something out. Then her eyes widened. Griff, they wouldn't go near Tobanth. They were running without their signature key. Both ships were. Whatever they were doing was completely off the books. They didn't want witnesses. There's nothing else worth looking at out here, Griff said. Amos nodded. Exactly. And if I had a secret, I'd put it someplace where it wasn't worth looking. So, my guess? The squib went to one of Uru's moons. Griff opened his mouth to protest, then stopped. Ubachi was a tiny system. It had 3 planets. Zik, a small cinder of a rock so close to Ubachi that it was a miracle it hadn't burned away. Tobanth, the mining colony, and Uru, the gas giant. Zik was useless. Anything on it had a tendency to melt. Uru had 11 moons, though none of them had anything particularly valuable. That made them exactly the kind of moons the Tylaris Barony would be completely uninterested in. Which would make one of them the perfect place for the Tylaris Barony to hide something in. I think you're right. They were trying to get to one of Uru's moons, got intercepted, and whoever piloted the squib decided it was close enough to try to make the rest of the trip. Amos looked at the schematic of the Obachi system on the big screen. Morgan, can you just show us Uru and her moons? Morgan nodded, keyed in a command, and the screen updated. We don't have anything useful on record about any of these. Just different official-sounding variations of nothing interesting here. We want something very uninteresting, Griff said. Something dead, I think. Completely dead. No minerals, nothing that would make people want to mine it, explore it, or plant a flag of any kind. One that says, oh, the Tylaris Barony would never be interested in this place. Well, Morgan keyed in some commands, and 4 of the moons lit up on the screen. I'd say that gives us 4 choices. Ogo, Muradi, Vushur, and Los. 11, 9, 8, and 5, Griff said. I guess we'll have to... Mac's voice broke in over the comm channel. Captain, we're standing outside the Apex lock. Could somebody maybe open the door for us? Griff blinked in surprise. Morgan, why didn't you notice our team was back? Because I was looking up planets for you, Morgan said. Right. Okay. Griff walked over to the lift and punched the intercom. Mac, we'll send someone up right away. You're just in time. We found another wild goose. There was a short pause on the other end. That sounds like fun, Max said. Does it involve radioactive clouds or swarms of razor-sharp debris? Not overtly, but we might get caught in the middle of warring factions in the Tylaris Barony. There was another slightly longer pause on the other end. In that case, Max said, you're buying us 2 rounds. After Faldith announced the channel was closed, Griff started laughing.
I agree with you, Morgan. I like him, too. The intercom crackled on again.
What the hell, Griff?
Cyrus sounded alarmed.
Did you just say we were going to start a war with the Tyleris Barony?
No, Griff said, sounding a bit defensive. I said we were going to get caught in the middle of one that already existed. Kitka broke in, stating that, for the record, it had just won the bet.
The hell you did,
Cyrus protested. The bet was for something happening while we collected fuel. We haven't even got to Uru yet. There's no way this counts. Kitka replied that they never would have noticed the fighting ships if they hadn't planned to stop at Uru to refuel, which tied the encounter directly to the decision.
That's a technicality, Cyrus said.
Griff, Amos, and Morgan all shouted at exactly the same time. The technicalities always count. Cyrus swore under his breath.
Fine. You win, Bug. Don't let it go to your head.
Kitka replied that its head was merely the place where its eyes and mandibles were located. Griff returned to his chair and slid it back down into the pilot's nest. Now that we've got that settled... Amos, why don't you lay in a course for the furthest moon out? Which one is that? 11. Ogo, Amos said. Working it up now.
I might actually be able to pick up a radiation trail from there, Morgan said. Depending on the engine the squib is using. And whether we get lucky.
Griff laughed. Well, I wouldn't count on that. But it's better than nothing. 20 minutes later, Mac and his crew were on board. The course was set, and the fool's errand was on her way. Chapter 6. Wherein our hero stumbles into the thick of it, and finds the experience regrettable. Ogo was the Invaji word for pretender, and the description was apt. It was much too small to be considered a proper moon. It was, more accurately, a fragment of an asteroid that got caught in Uru's gravity well and wound up taking a stable orbit around it. It was classified as a moon because the unmanned probe that first mapped the system experienced a programming error in the algorithm used to differentiate between moons and rogue debris. Bureaucracy being what it was, the designation had never been corrected, and all official star and system charts listed Ogo as the 11th moon of Uru. Today, Ogo was receiving more attention than it had for most of its history. Shortly after coming into sensor range, Morgan announced he'd found something. There's a radiation trail that ends at the moon. Morgan sounded pleased by the discovery. Can't find any sign of the craft, though.
So it landed on Ogo, Griff said impatiently. Where is it?
I don't know, Morgan said. I don't see it on the surface. It might take a while to search. There's a lot of ground to cover.
I've seen cities bigger than this moon, Griff said dismissively. And they were crowded. This place is empty.
The hell you say, Morgan growled. It's covered with craters. Some of the craters have craters. Some of the craters look like they connect to other craters. And if I were going to hide a small ship from prying eyes and sensor optics, I'd be looking for a...
Morgan's voice trailed off.
Morgan?
Or maybe it won't take a while to search, Morgan said. Maybe I'll just stumble across the damn thing while I'm trying to explain to you how hard it is to do my job.
Griff tried to keep the grin out of his voice.
Let's see it.
The tactical screen on Griff's station shifted as one of Uru's craters displayed. The glint of something not rock could be seen poking just over the crater's rim.
I think this is probably what you're looking for, Morgan said.
Good job.
Griff adjusted their orbit to take them out of the crater. Let's get a closer look. The crater was larger than most of its neighbors, easily 4 or 5 times the size of the Fool's Errand. The squib rested close to one of the crater walls. It was misshapen, not designed to be aerodynamic, but to resemble a broken, twisted piece of hull. A long furrow in the ground behind it suggested it had not landed gently.
There's residual heat from the engine, Morgan said. No heat from the cockpit, though. Either it's empty or the pilot is dead.
Well, Griff said, I suppose we need to find out.
He activated the intercom. I'll stand by to land.
The crater was large enough for the Fool's Errand, so Griff set it down on the other side.
After the ship settled, Griff moved his seat back into the bridge. Hammis, you have the bridge? Faldith, get Max, Sar, and Kitka into Bay 1 and tell them to suit up. Well, don't tell Kitka to suit up. Hammis raised an eyebrow. And where do you think you're going? Griff grinned. I'm going out. I want to see what's in the squib. I don't think that's a good idea, Hammis said. I don't either, Morgan said. Actually, I think that's a pretty bad idea, all things considered. Griff grinned even wider. Too bad. What did you think this was, a military boat? We don't have regulations here, just my caprice and whimsy. Bay 1 was one of the three largest spaces in the Fool's Errand. It was currently empty, except for the loading and unloading equipment that the crew used to handle their cargo, and for the line of lockers near the Nader Lock, which contained protective gear. Mac and Sar were already there when Griff arrived. Sar was getting into his vacuum suit. Mac was inspecting his rifle. Both looked up at Griff. Mac nodded and raised his weapon a bit. We are going armed, right, Captain?
Hell yes, Griff said.
Kitka entered Bay 1, chittering nervously about the engines. Kitka was 2.5 meters long and stood 2 meters high. It looked like a cross between a beetle and a centipede, with the addition of 3 long prehensile tails at the end. Kitka's race had a semi-external carapace, which was capable of withstanding pressures and radiation levels well above the norm for humanoid races. They could survive in vacuum and go without oxygen for hours at a time, which was convenient. They also had, as far as Griff could tell, thousands of tiny feet. A vacuum suit for a bug would be expensive to tailor. Kitka asked Griff what they were hoping to find. Griff shrugged. No idea, but we stumbled into something interesting and unusual. I want to know more. Kitka replied that the last time they tried to investigate something that Griff thought was interesting and unusual, they wound up in jail. We did, Griff said, but only because I was right. Kitka noted that being right was largely irrelevant when you were also in jail. I agree with you on general principle, Griff said, but it was, you have to admit, very interesting. Kitka emitted an annoyed buzz and didn't answer. It could have been worse. It wasn't steal from the Radiant Throne and have a bounty the size of Tylaris Prime put on my head interesting. That much? Mac asked. No wonder we don't go into throne space. Kitka made a sound that was the bug equivalent of a derisive snort. It stated that the bounty grew larger every time Griff told the story. Hey, Griff protested, that's not my fault. Well, I suppose it is, actually. But in my defense, I have a reputation to maintain. Kitka suggested that it was possible for Griff to maintain his reputation without resorting to lies and embellishments. Nonsense. What about the part of my reputation that calls me a liar and an embellisher? Kitka chose not to reply. Instead, it placed the helmet over its eyes and mandibles and sealed it shut. The helmet wasn't necessary for its survival, but it allowed Kitka to communicate with the rest of the group. Griff got into a vacuum suit. A few minutes later, they were all going down the Nader Lock and out onto the surface of Ogo. The gravity on Ogo was nearly non-existent, so they took propulsion sleds. The interior of this crater was unusually smooth. The only part of the surface that was marred was the furrow the squib left from its graceless landing. Odd place to land, Mac noted. His voice echoed in Griff's ear. Griff muttered a vocal cue to turn down the volume in his headset. Yeah, Griff said. Odd enough to be interesting. Kitka wished aloud that Griff would stop using that word. They activated their sleds, gliding across the surface of the crater toward the squib. It sat silent and gray in the distance. Be careful, Griff. Amos sounded annoyed. That usually meant she was worried. Sure thing, Mom. As they drew near the squib, Griff ordered Mac and Sar to hang back, weapons ready. Griff and Kitka moved in for a closer look. It was exactly what Mac had estimated based on the launch pad. Just large enough for a small engine, basic life support, navigation, and a single passenger, with the possible addition of some light cargo if necessary. Griff moved to the front of the craft, while Kitka moved to the rear. It doesn't look as sound up close as it did from a distance. Kitka agreed.
Do you think it was trying to get here? Mac asked. Or do you think it was trying to get to one of the other moons and it just couldn't make it?
Don't know, Griff said. If we can find a way inside, we might get some kind of clue.
Try the top, Mac said. A squib is usually set into its launch mechanism. 9 times out of 10, entry is from the top.
Right.
Griff pointed the propulsion sled up and let it elevate him so he could get an aerial view.
Ah, I see the hatch.
Griff landed gently on the top of the squib and felt the contacts on his boots click as they touched the hull. He walked over to the hatch. Electronically sealed, of course.
We'll have to crack it. Mac.
Mac put his rifle back into the holster on his propulsion sled, then glided over. He stomped over to the hatch, looked it over once, then went back to the sled, where he began to assemble a laser torch.
You know, Mac said, as soon as we break through this seal, whatever atmosphere is in there will be gone. Anyone inside is going to be pissed.
There's nobody inside this thing, Griff said. Nobody alive.
Kitka agreed. It pointed out that the lack of power readings suggested systems failure, probably from the crash. Mac started up the torch. Griff and Kitka stood back as he began to cut through the top.
Well, Mac said, the good news is it won't take us very long to find out. She's cutting through pretty quick. And it looks like there was atmosphere in there after all, because it's leaking out the... What the hell?
Mac staggered back in alarm as something red blew out the cut he made in the hull.
What is that, coolant?
Mac edged away from the stream of liquid, checking his suit to see if any of it got on the fabric. Some coolants were corrosive and could eat through a standard vac suit's lining.
I was only working on one of the hinges. It shouldn't have...
Look up, Griff said. The red rose up past them as they watched, separating into tiny globes. Blood. Let's get that hatch open.
The occupant isn't going to care.
They waited for the blood to stop jetting out of the breach before Mac got back to work. When he was finished, he and Kitka unceremoniously ripped the hatch from the hull, Kitka doing most of the difficult work, and pushed it away from the squib. The hatch floated to the rim of the crater where it slowly, very, very slowly, began to sink to the ground. Mac turned on a flashlight attached to his suit's glove. Griff did the same thing.
Poor bastard, Mac said.
There were globes of blood everywhere.
Sar, take a look, Griff said. You're the smallest, you'll probably be able to get around the best.
The Gagrulsha grunted in agreement. He holstered his rifle, guided his propulsion sled over to the top of the squib, then slipped his way through the hatch.
I found the body,
Sar growled.
Part of the pilot station tore loose on impact, impaled him, tore open his chest.
That's lovely, Griff said. How much room down there?
Not much.
Sar hermed to himself for a moment.
The squib is carrying cargo.
Griff raised an eyebrow. What is it?
I don't know. It's large. I am not sure how they managed to place it in the vessel. It will not fit through the hatch.
Kitka suggested they may have built the squib around the cargo.
Maybe, Griff said.
In any event, the trick is to get the cargo out.
Amos, you listening?
Right here, Griff.
Amos's voice was crisp and professional. That meant she was either angry and trying not to show it, or curious and trying not to show it.
Bring the ship right up to us and have Cyrus and the rest of Mac's crew suit up. We're going to use the crane to pull the squib into Bay 3.
Be right there.
Griff felt, rather than heard, the rumble of the Fool's Errand's engines as they fired up. As Amos took the ship up, a cloud of dirt and dust billowed out from its wake, quickly overtaking Kitka, Mac, and Griff, covering them in a layer of grime.
Love this job, Mac muttered.
It gets better.
Griff stared into the darkened hatch thoughtfully.
We need to get that body out of there. Sar, can you unhook the pilot from the crash webbing?
Yes,
Sar said.
There. He is now free, Captain. What shall I do with him?
Just pass him up here, Griff said.
We're gonna bury him?
Mac asked.
Griff frowned.
What?
No. Well, why would we do that?
Respect for the dead?
Max suggested. Well, you know what? It's not like I feel any ill will toward the guy, and I'll admit, taking his ship and leaving his body behind is a little cold-blooded, but I figure at this point he's not going to be offended.
Yeah, Max said reluctantly. I guess. I am sending him up, Sar warned.
Then Griff saw the dead man's head poke through the hatch. Griff gritted his teeth, then reached down, grabbed the corpse's shoulders, and pulled. The pilot's torso was very unpleasant to see, and there were parts of it that were normally hidden that were now prominently on display. He tugged again, and the rest of the body floated up and out. As he dragged it down the length of the squib's hull, he could feel the ground vibrate as Amos landed the fool's errand a short distance from it. Right, Griff said. Let's see who this poor bastard is. Kitka, I need you to search the corpse. My gloves are too thick for this kind of work. Two of Kitka's tails snaked around the body, searching through the dead man's pockets. It asked if it was considered standard practice in human society to rifle through the pockets of the dead. Yes, Griff said, but usually a government does it first. Kitka retrieved a data card from the dead man's jacket pocket. Griff fumbled with the panel on his chest and popped open the cover to his suit's reader. Let me take a look. Kitka inserted the data card into Griff's reader. Immediately, a name and a face appeared on the heads-up display in Griff's helmet.
Well, damn it all to hell.
What? Amos cut in again, wary.
Nothing.
Griff.
Nothing,
Griff repeated. He looked at the name and scowled. Of course, by nothing, I mean every damn thing in the galaxy. We're going to have to take the body with us. I guess we'll need something to put it in.
Griff.
Amos's wariness had morphed into resignation.
Exactly who was piloting that squib?
Is it someone we know?
No, Griff said, not exactly. We never met, but I'm pretty sure you'll recognize the name.
Assuming the card isn't stolen, the pilot of the squib was Stebel Tanz. There was a long, drawn-out silence on the line. A moment later, both Amos and Cyrus began cursing over the channel. He thought he heard Morgan in the background as well.
I am not familiar with the name, Sar said.
Stebel Tanz was the old Baron Tylaris's doctor, Griff said. The one who found him dead. The one who performed the autopsy on the body. Kitka chittered uneasily and shoved the body a little farther away from itself with one of its tails. Mac pointed at the body.
He was on the Soontz transport?
Yeah, Griff said. It looks that way.
Damn it all!
Cyrus snarled over the intercom.
That's just... It's just...
His voice trailed off.
Damn. How do you do it, Griff?
Griff looked down at the body and sighed.
It's a gift.
This has been an audiobook podcast of A Rake by Starlight, written and narrated by C.B. Wright. It is published as part of his Patreon campaign, where he creates serial fiction and other acts of publishing villainy. To support this podcast and gain access to other rewards, consider subscribing at patreon.com/eviscerati. That's patreon.com/EVISCERATI. A Rake by Starlight is the sequel to Pay Me Bub, originally published in 2011 and available in ebook and trade paperback format through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, and other online retailers. This podcast is distributed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike 4.0 license. You are free to copy, distribute, and modify this podcast as long as you properly identify C.B. Wright as the original creator. Also, you cannot charge money for copying, distributing, or modifying this work. More information about this license can be found at creativecommons.org. The music used in this podcast, Neutralize Bomb, was composed by Snow Music Studio and is licensed through melodyloops.com. It is not included in the Creative Commons license and must be licensed separately for derivative works.